everyone. Welcome to another episode of Work in Progress.
This is Sim.
This is Ko. And today we're really, really excited to have Devika Suresh with us. She's the innovation specialist at the Good Food Institute. As part of her role there, she oversees the talent and workforce development and builds career pathways for India's youth to enter this sunrise sector, which is of alternate proteins. She's an alumni of the India Smart Protein Innovation Challenge. She's led its subsequent iteration and continues to provide strategic advisory and build the enabling ecosystem for smart protein companies in India to scale. She's also established India's first chapter of the Alt Protein Project, seeding smart protein innovation at universities and helping center young Indians in the food system conversation. So welcome, Devika. Thank you so much for joining us. Side note, I recently heard Devika speak and was really inspired. So feeling very, very grateful to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad you reached out.
Yeah. Also, the episode today, we're calling it The Future of Food, but we're also going to cover climate and planetary health. It's going to talk a lot about alternate proteins and also Devika's personal journey. So let's just get into it.
Yeah, so alternate protein is such a fascinating space. And I think before we read about you and really not gone deep into what it is exactly. Mm-hmm. So what do you think alternate protein is for you, and how did you get into the space overall?
Yeah, I think it was about like 4 years ago when I think peak pandemic, I decided to go vegan. And this was sort of overnight, cold turkey. I come from Kerala, by the way, where my entire family is like staunchly non-vegetarian. So they kind of looked at me with mix of awe and horror. I remember my grandmother even told me like, oh my God, your grandfather would be so disappointed if he found out. But yeah, I think that was the real moment where I started thinking about my food, about what it does to the planet, what it does for animal welfare, all of that. I had a lot of time on my hands. I was watching every documentary. I was reading anything that I could get my hands on. I wanted someone to tell me that I really did not have an option, or the choice that I was making was not really affecting the environment. But everything that I read told me otherwise. So I just couldn't look back after that. After which, when I sort of like started talking to my family about how can you really sustainably make a shift with your food, it didn't seem like a viable alternative to tell my family to, okay, from tomorrow start having like chole instead of chicken. Yeah. That really did not fly. And I knew that there had to be like a bigger solution to this. And I really wanted to be part of that solution. And as fate would have it, the India Smart Protein Innovation Challenge was running its first iteration during the pandemic, and it had just launched by GFI India. And a friend of mine was like, oh, you really wanted to start up in the space. You wanted to be part of the solution. I think this is the perfect opportunity. And I ended up applying. It was, I think, a 6-month journey where I ended up being a finalist. I was very close to starting my own brand in this space, but in retrospect, I think it was a good decision that I didn't go ahead with it, because I was fairly new to the sector, didn't know much about it, didn't know anything about business. But yeah, I just knew that I couldn't go back to my software job. I was in a very like desk sad software job at that point. So I started cold emailing all the brands that I now work with, saying, hey, can I volunteer for you? I just really want to work in this space. And then GFI got back and said, no, you can actually apply for a job. We can pay you to do this. Yeah, and I've been with GFI since. It's been like a great 3.5 years.
That's incredible. Let's talk a little bit about GFI. Like, what is GFI and what is your role? What does your day-to-day look like? What do you look after there? And I think importantly, what is their vision and why does that align with you so strongly?
Yeah, I think everything about GFI at that point seemed to resonate with me, and it still does. And I'm really happy to be working for an organization that just mirrors my own values. GFI, in its essence, is a network of nonprofits. So they work across the world. It's there in 7 different regions. And I work for the India affiliate. We work to make alternative protein no longer an alternative. We're trying to build a better food system that is secure, safe, sustainable, and also just and accessible for all. And we're trying to do that through this transition towards smart proteins, as we call it. So smart proteins are products that viably alternative for meat, eggs, dairy, and seafood. We try to do this through multiple tech modalities. So this could be by creating these products from plants, deriving them from microbes, or like directly cultivating them from cells. As of today, we have over 100 different startups in the space. And my job primarily is to support these startups. So anything right from sourcing the ingredients right up to branding, marketing, hiring, fundraising. I try to support these startups. And we do this completely pro bono. All our kind of work is funded by philanthropy globally as well. We try to act as like a neutral thought leader, convening body in the space. We try to bring together industry, academia, as well as government. We have three different verticals that work towards this mission for smart protein. I work primarily within industry. So we work with startups. We work with the bigger corporates like your Nestle's and your ITC's that's looking to enter the space. Apart from that, something that I do that is sort of like a passion project of mine is I lead the talent development efforts at GFI India. So somewhat of a full circle moment for me. I now run the challenge that I was part of. I think I'm kind of like the poster child for the challenge now, because like, oh, she was you know, in the program and now she's running it. But I truly enjoy the work that I do there because it's kind of helping facilitate better career transitions, kind of the opportunities that I was looking for when I was a young person trying to make better choices with my career. I also help mentor university students that's trying to enter the space, trying to start startups, as well as bringing like courses into their curriculum, etc. So yeah, a bunch of different things. But yeah.
No, that's really, really interesting. And one thing that when you were talking really caught to me, and when we were doing our research also we noticed, is GFI is very intentional with the use, the word use of smart protein instead of alternate protein.
Yeah.
So could you like expand on that, why that's the case for y'all?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think we're the only affiliate that does that. Like every other region goes by alternative protein. India in general has used the smart positioning for projects and policies that are more tech forward or sustainable, like smart cities.
Yeah.
And we've seen that that works really well with like the government, policymakers, industry in general. It also supplements that notion of this is not a replacement. It is protein diversification at the end of the day. Because alternatives tend to say that, okay, we're going to move away from legacy protein overnight, which is not what we're trying to do. We're trying to supplement existing diets. So overall, that's been really helpful for us to go into a room and say, this is a new emerging category that's very tech forward, and we're not trying to take meat off your plates. We're trying to supplement it with better meat.
And I think like in the Bio3E policy, if I'm wording that correctly, they also use the term smart protein. Yeah. So like seeing that conjunction was really interesting as well.
I just have a broader question. So while you've explained what smart protein is and alternate protein is, when we zoom out and think about food and climate security, how does this interlink? And why should someone who's not had this personal journey care? You know, why does it matter? And why are these words linked together?
Yeah, no, really good question. Like, whenever we position smart protein, we try to position it for who we are speaking to. So when we speak to the government, we often bring in the food security angle. Yeah. So in general, our current food system and the way we produce food is not equipped to feed the population, the growing population that's upwardly mobile, that's going to start eating more protein, that's young, that wants to emulate the West and wants to emulate their eating habits as well. So in general, we do need a better system of food. And our current system of food is actually quite inefficient. So if you look at how many calories in and out goes into an animal, so you need to feed 9 calories of feed to a chicken for it to give you 1 calorie of food. And this is the most efficient of all the animals that people consume.
Right.
So overall, for me, when I was turning vegan as well, because I grew up eating non-veg, the animal welfare angle didn't come up front. It's this angle of, oh, it's just inefficient. Why not just cut out the middleman?
Yeah.
Sorry to use those terms, mm-hmm. but directly consume protein, right? Instead of going through that process of investing in a system that is essentially broken at this point. So that's kind of the food security lens of it. From a climate lens, all of these products that we're talking about consume vastly less amount of land, water, energy, and even in terms of emissions, it's much lesser than the legacy animal protein. And then there's like the larger kind of public health point of view as well. I think post-pandemic, there was just this recognition of zoonotic diseases and how that affects, right? And just being prepared for a future pandemic, people really moved away from eating a lot of animals and really thinking about where your food is coming from. There's also this risk of antimicrobial resistance. So a lot of these animals are kept under really unhygienic conditions. So they're pumped with antibiotics so that they're able to be consumed later and they can like grow to the size wherein you can also consume that meat. So then in turn, you are also consuming those antibiotics and slowly your body becomes resistant to antibiotics. There was a recent study which showed that I think by 2025, there's going to be 40 million deaths just from antimicrobial resistance. So what that would look like is people would be dying from common colds because drugs would not be working anymore. So I think from like a climate lens, a public health lens, a planetary health lens, there's a lot that Smart Protein can do. But it's really about like understanding what it can do for a country like India, which unfortunately, even though might not be contributing to climate change at the scale where the developed world is, will disproportionately bear the brunt or the consequences of climate change.
Yeah. And do you feel from a, like you said, you need to understand it better, that it is still a sunrise industry. Yeah. So awareness is very low and people are still trying to grapple to terms with it. If I could have an alternate industry example, do you think electric vehicles is makes sense?
Yeah.
And to that, the question is, there's again so much doubt and uncertainty and the narrative keeps changing. Is it good? Is it not good? So in your research and your understanding, how does one think about the consumer perception of it? You know, there's still, again, doubt and uncertainty when you say Smart Protein. There's a lot of different connotations that come to mind where, yes, I understand it's good, but then there are so many questions. But is it not, like, you know, is it synthetic? Is it really better? So I think just head on, what are your thoughts on that?
And also just adding to what Ko said, I think from a broader perspective, for me, for example, I'm a proper non-vegetarian. So like even thinking about what's the difference between vegan, vegetarian and like Smart Protein, where what are the nuances and differences between these terms which are thrown at us, then like then making a decision at the what type of food protein do I take. So I feel like that understanding is also a little lacking in our culture today. But like,
No, fair enough. I think in general, there is a lot of consumer confusion in the sector because, like you said, there's a lot of different terminology being thrown at the consumer. And the consumer right now is so knowledgeable, wants to know everything about what's going into their diets, which I think is great. Like, you should be looking at the back of your packaging. You should be trying to understand what everything that you're putting into your body is. But with that, what kind of sets in is a fear of the unknown, right? Like, I've never consumed this product. I've not heard of it. But I've seen, like, something in the media, like Kim Kardashian is eating it. Like, I know that. But I think what really helps with the consumer is meeting them where they're at. So if you're able to provide a product that tastes the same or better, costs the same or less, and it's just widely accessible, like if I can order it on my quick commerce, then I'm willing to try it. Right now, I think that's really the challenge. Like from a taste, price and convenience perspective, it's not reached the point wherein it's at parity and for me to just quickly order a product and trial it. And then I might try it again or like, you know, make a repeat purchase. So till we're able to solve for those three aspects, the consumer acceptance really becomes like a later challenge for us to tackle. So right now, our focus has been to bring economies of scale, try to like expand on manufacturing, tech, make sure that the startups have enough funding so that they're able to bring these products to you at a price that is affordable. And then we kind of get to the consumer element as well. But in terms of like the vegan, vegetarian, plant-based positioning, what we have tried to do as GFI and as a neutral think tank in the space is we do constant like consumer testing and studies. That's quite neutral. Like we are not endorsing like one product over the other. We do like blind taste tests, all of that. And then we just present the research. Like so many people resonate with the term vegan over plant-based. What we've seen is that vegan usually restricts people to a niche because it immediately makes you think, oh, this is for vegans and not for me, which is not true. These products are for everyone. In fact, it's actually for the non-vegetarians. But yeah, I think going with the terminology of plant-based really does open it up to a wider audience. But even within plant-based, there's some confusion because plant-based usually means predominantly plant-based and not 100%, which again creates consumer confusion. We are of the notion that you shouldn't water down the term plant-based. Plant-based should mean 100% plant-based. It should be sourced from plants. And then vegetarian has like different connotations. It can include dairy. It can sometimes include egg. So yeah, that's a completely different category in itself. But yeah, the way we're seeing it is if you're able to tackle all the other challenges that come before consumer acceptance, it'll just follow.
I think one other thing that when we were doing our research, we were reading about and talking about it. I think you did an interview, which we saw on LinkedIn, where you were talking about cultural resonance of the products and like how at this point, if you go to like a Nature's Basket, if you go to the plant-based section, there are like nuggets or like burger patties and stuff like that, which might not predominantly be a person's everyday meal. So that was something really interesting that we read and would love for you to expand on that.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think when the plant-based boom happened, that was also like very much during the pandemic where people were looking for quick, easy meals that they can just microwave and ready to cook, ready to eat. But now we've moved away from that. People really want to cook their own food. And that is the Indian way of eating. We want to eat fresh food. We want to add our own little spice to it. So even if it's like from a ready-to-cook packet, I'm going to add like some masala from like my end also to say that this is my cooking. So in general, and I think brands are already like catching on to that and at least going the meal kit route so that people feel like they are part of the recipe development, they're making their own products. But we're still a long way from these products being truly versatile and adaptable to the Indian cooking format. Like we would need for these products to be available in like curry cut for there to be like a biryani or like a chicken kebab or anything that really resonates with the Indian consumer. Until then, I think like it's quite the challenge for people to truly adopt these products.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, again, macro question, a lot of the reports that, you know, we read spoke to how we as a country are strategically positioned to win, you know, in this space from a geographical point of view, from a climate point of view. And why is that so, you know, and why does also Good Food Institute and similar organizations want to double down specifically on this industry?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that India does really, really well. One of which is manufacturing. Mm. And we have this huge legacy food processing sector that we can really retrofit for this emerging sector, right? A lot of the companies in our space are also legacy companies in like the bakery industry or the pasta industry or like the pulse milling industry who are now looking at like other sources of revenue. So we have that backing of like having like a really strong agri sector. With that also comes the biodiversity of agriculture. Like, I think globally, a lot of the companies are also trying to move away from the hero ingredient of soy. So they're looking for other products. They're looking for millets and pulses, which is all like endemic to India. So India will soon become like the ingredient sourcing or manufacturing hub for a lot of these products. And that's only on the plant-based side. So when you come to the cultivated or fermentation side, that's more of a biotech game, which again, India is one of the largest bioeconomies. Yeah. And we do have the capacity to retrofit a lot of our biopharma and biotech towards these emerging sectors. We are producing vaccines for the whole world at a lower cost. So we would be able to do that for other sectors as well. And the third thing I would say is the talent. Like we have skilled scientific talent, which is also affordable for the global population, that can really like skill up and start working in these sectors.
Right. And just to double click on bioeconomy, for us as well, could you explain what you mean by bioeconomy?
Yeah, we have been hearing it a lot in the past few weeks because of the G20 and then consequently, there were some updates on the BioE3 policy that we were mentioning before. Just for our listeners, just to understand what exactly it is, it would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think if I were to explain it in my own words, bioeconomy essentially means promoting the use of biotechnology for sustainable development. So building a circular bioeconomy or implementing sustainable practices in subsectors like pharma, biotech, bio-IT, etc. Where smart protein really comes in is with something like the BioE3 policy, which is also targeted towards meeting our 2070 net zero emissions goal, wherein smart protein has been identified as like a major thematic area. So the government really wants to double down on like funding as well as R&D and infrastructure for these products to gain wide scale adoption.
And also you mentioned millets, and I think me and Ko were joking when we were hearing the last budget that this is the International Year of Millets, and that's all we heard Modi speak about. And consequently, we saw a lot of companies like get into the millet game. I wouldn't have personally thought that, it could be used as a smart protein or an alternative protein XYZ. But like, how has like the government's agenda helped y'all like maybe move at a faster pace than y'all would have like few years ago?
Oh, 100%. I think the International Year of Millets is a great example because, like you said, it was like a poor man's crop that nobody had heard of. And suddenly, I think within a year, the sales of millets, both domestically and export.
Like, McDonald's has a millet burger.
Like, it's
exactly,
insane.
Exactly. It rose by like 30%, which is saying something for sure. In general, I think in the budget this year as well, there's just a lot of importance on emerging fields like climate tech and agri-tech, which helps us position smart protein as under that umbrella and make it more resonant for the government. Because otherwise, it just seems like something completely different and usually would come under like, okay, is it organic or is it like, what does this come under? But we are really trying to position it as like a tech forward play more than anything else. So that has been really helpful.
Yeah. I wanted to shift gears a bit and take us back to consumer perception. I read something really interesting, I think, in what you've spoken or came across from GFI about how in general consumers or in India consumers tend to find meat aspirational. So how do you convince that consumer that, you know, plant-based alternatives are the same, you're not compromising on taste, but it actually might be better. And where does that thinking come from? Like, I have not thought of it that way at all. And also in terms of identification, I think one of the things that really stayed with me when I heard you speak was that everyone assumes India is a vegetarian country, but actually, and that's me as well, actually you're flexitarian or it's convenient or, you know, you might be eating 1 out of 10 times non-vegetarian, but you would still say you are vegetarian. Whereas I think the stat was 70%. Just would love for you to speak on that.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that stuck with you because it stuck with me as well. Because even though I grew up non-vegetarian, I very much thought I lived in a vegetarian country. Because even in my school, it was mandated that you should only have vegetarian food. And it was almost like, okay, this is not like, this is against our culture. But at that point, I think when I'd first like started getting in the know of GFI and reading a lot of our reports, the National Health and Family Survey said that 77% of Indians self-identify as non-vegetarian. This can be often misconstrued as, oh, we're eating like the West, wherein I'm eating non-veg every
meal.
Yeah, or it's like center of my plate and protein is the main aspect. it's usually a side dish. It's usually like once or twice a week or even occasion specific. In fact, we know a brand, Licious, right, that launched a plant-based meat product. And the entire thought process behind that was apparently there's 100 days in a year that an average Indian does not eat meat, purely from religious and cultural perspectives. Like, they just don't want to consume meat. So that's really an opportunity because India has that guilty non-veg cohort, which is such a nuanced thing, which becomes an opportunity for a lot of these startups. In fact, I think a few different startups launched during Navratri saying, these are products that your mom would approve of during Navratri. So I think there is this growing appetite for meat, even though the per capita consumption might be less. Our population is so large that it's significant enough for us to consider. And to feed that population that has disposable income, really wants to eat more protein. And in general, this is a known phenomenon that as incomes increase, people want to eat more fats and proteins. So we're not anticipating that the meat intake is going to rise to a level wherein we're not going to be able to support it. And that's just something that we have to come to terms with, I think. And from like an aspiration point of view, I think the idea is to still provide these products, not reduce on like the delectable nature of these products or say that it's not indulgent, it's healthy. No, these are meat products just made in a better way. So your plate might still look the same and it should look the same and it should taste the same, but it's just made in a way that's not breaking the planet.
So GFI, like you mentioned, works with like various companies to get this forward. Like you mentioned, Licious also. Y'all are working with Nestle. Like last year, 2023, if I'm not mistaken, many of Nestle's like alternative or smart protein products had to be pulled back. But they are making a strong push this year to maybe get that back to the Indian market. Why do you think maybe that failed in a developed country as such? And like, how do you think it's different now, like in a span of a year, and why India would be different in that way?
Yeah, very good question. I think it's been a struggle whenever a corporate or a larger food company has put out a product and it's been taken back because it's not great for optics for the sector in general. I think what usually happens is for a corporate, this is a very small part of their entire portfolio. So it's not like they're investing a lot of money into their R&D. They're just doing like a test launch to see, okay, will the consumer buy this? Do I want to invest more money into it? As opposed to a startup wherein I'm a smart protein startup, I'm going to invest my all into making this product the best product. So I think the way forward for a lot of these corporates, and it's happening globally as well, and I hope we see more of this in India, is that they partner with a lot of smaller startups. So that could be from like a tech licensing point of view or even like a merger or an acquisition. Because I know a lot of brands who even start up thinking that, okay, I want to eventually sell to a bigger company because I'm making a really good product. That also helps corporates go to market faster because for a corporate, there might be longer R&D cycles, there might be a lot more red tape, whereas a startup gets to be riskier, gets to do a bunch of different trials. Even if they go to market with a product which is not completely there, they can still take it back and then come out with a better product and just position it better.
And it wouldn't make that much noise also.
Exactly. So hopefully in the future, corporates are going to look at this as like an opportunity in terms of, hey, I could partner with a multiple, you know, multiple different startups and maybe make a whole suite of like plant-based offerings.
And in terms of the category creation here in India, why is this the same pattern in global markets as well? I read, I think 60% is alt milk here. Maybe it's the same elsewhere as well, because you have been hearing a lot about just alt milk in general. And there are so many Indian fun startups. But why do you think that's the case? Is it easier to accept, or is dairy so much like in our conscious minds that it's easier to make that move with it?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think soy milk has been around for so long, maybe not as widely popular, but like at least for people who are lactose intolerant, you always knew that soy milk is an option. So it didn't feel like you're creating a new category with plant-based milk. Also from a tech perspective, the barrier to entry is a lot lower. Like me sitting in a home kitchen could also make an almond milk. Like during the pandemic, I used to make my own almond milk. Exactly. It might not be the best, but it's still almond milk. And I think another thing is that in general, meat is a lot more nuanced. You need to also offer versatility of like cooking. It needs to sizzle a certain way. It needs to like be fatty and juicy. Whereas plant-based milk is just like an alternative that you can sub out. And it's very much seen that way that, okay, if today I don't want to be heavy on my stomach and my doctor's told me to stay off the dairy, I can go for like an alt milk option. And it's also just widely available everywhere. I don't know, like I think the penetration at least within like QSRs and like cafes in general, you find a lot more alt milk brands for sure.
A while back, you mentioned just plate of food, and it reminded me of the, we spoke about this earlier, we're now moving to the future, that by 2050, the planet will be inhabited by 10 billion people. 1/6 will be Indian. If we want to feed everyone in a sustainable, healthy, and just way, we have to reimagine our sources of food. One, what food do we imagine our plate to have in 2050? And how has that historically changed, or how is it really going to be impacted? How can we think about this more actively?
Yeah, no, great question. I love how you framed it as well. I'm hoping that people get to consume exactly what they have been consuming and are finding enjoyable, but are produced in better ways. So I'm hoping that the food will look similar, the plate would look similar. It'll just be more conscious, like what you're exactly putting in the center of your plate, what you're having as a side dish, all of that would be a very consumer-driven choice. And all of these options are presented to you. So I'm not saying that, okay, it should look like a plant-based meal or it should look like a heavy carnivore meal or somewhere in between. But I'm just saying that if I wanted to make the choice and if I wanted access to these options, I would have it. And I would have it at a price point that is accessible to me as well across India, like not specifically to like tier one, tier two cities, but it's like a mass market product that I can also access. And this has happened before. Like if you look at like soy chunks, for instance, I don't think it was part of our diet, but Nutrella, the soy chunk company, they started this like 10 rupee soy chunk packet, which was available in your Kirana store. So like your daily wage worker who's coming back from work can access protein at 10 rupees and just take it home and cook it. So yeah, hopefully in the future, we're able to not just provide options, but provide it at a cost that everyone can afford.
Yeah. When we were researching also on the smart protein industry at a whole, we read few arguments against like smart proteins in general. One was like one interesting authored piece I read, which said that right now at the pace with which we are moving in this industry, which is quite quick in the past, maybe 1-2 years, and we are foreseeing it to go quicker. The one thing people might not be considering is that like rural livestock, animal husbandry are like really the backbone of rural economies. And what the author was saying was maybe the pace at which we are moving is not considering that it's going to disrupt a lot of livelihoods and households. So like, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, what do you think about this argument as a whole?
Yeah, no, it's a very fair argument because I feel like our economy is agrarian, and it is the heart and soul of that is the farmer and the livestock industry. So we're not saying this transition is going to happen overnight or it's going to be like a forcible transition. We are going to come to a point where we're not able to produce food the way that we've been able to right now at the scale that we want to. So in that sense, it's going to be supplementary income for farmers. You're going to be producing products out of those crops that are value added to the level wherein they are fetching a higher price. So at the end of the day, the farmer is still going to just kind of, you know, divide his cropland in a way that he wants to, but also catering to sectors like smart protein, which will fetch him a better price.
And like diversify his income as well. Exactly. Because maybe there are like with animal husbandry and everything, like you said before, microbial resistance is a big concern, etc. At least this way, maybe like if that doesn't work out, then he has an alternative source of income overall.
For sure. Which we saw during the pandemic as well. Like, that entire industry was disrupted.
Yeah, I think on this note of arguments against, again on perception, with organic, well, let's say climate, greenwashing is so predominant everywhere. And we see that, and there's one way it can again be bastardized. With the whole organic movement that has happened here as well. It's not just Western countries. How can we think of it differently, or as just people who are curious, prevent that from happening and prevent people from shrugging when you say, oh, alternate protein, you know? How do you not do that?
I would love the answer to that question. No, but seriously, I feel like what organic might have failed on in some respects is like the Indianization of that category. It still seemed quite elitist and unaccessible and just, okay, so you have a tomato and you have an organic tomato, I'm going to pick the cheaper option because I don't care at this point. We're hoping that doesn't happen with smart protein, with economies of scale. Like over time, these products are going to get cheaper. The choice of that is not going to look like a sacrifice. It's going to look like a simple switch. Like I'm going to see the plant-based meat option and the legacy meat option side by side, and I should be able to make that choice. Another thing, I feel like organic usually like tends to look at like going back to traditional and the way we ate, whereas smart protein is more like a tech forward emerging. We're trying to make a new innovative category. So I think in that sense, like comparing smart protein to EVs or solar is like a better comparison than organic. And hopefully people make that connect rather than making the organic connect.
Right. And I think on a note for your work, what are some of the startups, because you help startups scale as well, that you find really inspirational? I'm sure all of them, but like, what are a few that are really creating categories or challenging, you know, norms?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to the kind of work that they're doing. So there's a lot of startups working on this Indianization. Mm. So they're really working on formats that's easily adaptable to Indian cooking, which I think is really credible. And not just Indian cooking, but like regional formats. Right. So there will be like a Chettinad chicken, or there will be like a Hyderabadi biryani, which makes a lot of sense to me, because when you're cooking for India, you're cooking for different parts of India. There's also startups that's doing a lot on seafood as well, which is really difficult to crack in India, because how you eat across the coast looks wildly different. I come from Kerala, so I know that within Kerala itself, like just across the breadth of Kerala, we eat very different kinds of fish. So I think that's a really niche market that some startups are really looking at. There's also brands that are now trying to tap into like public procurement programs for like the midday meal scheme, which I think is a great way to access like the mass market, right? If you're able to provide your product at the price point that the midday meal scheme, midday meals are usually at, which is at like 10 to 15 rupees per child, that is a win. And I see a lot of startups like trying to scale to the point where they're able to provide that. There's also startups experimenting with the format. So trying not to be very dependent on the cold chain logistics, because that is so difficult in India. And that's not like a smart protein specific issue. With every sector in India, it's so hard to reach tier three cities that there's a lot of products that are now shelf stable, which allows them to be, you know, accessible across India. Apart from that, there's a lot of startups in the B2B space. Mm-hmm. So doing ingredients for the end product. There's a company that's doing plant-based fats, which is really interesting. So they're encapsulating fat so that when you bite into a piece of plant-based meat, it's really like, it just like gives you that mouth feel of like really biting into like a piece of meat, which I think is great. And which is what we hear from our consumer studies. So we did this study on what do you expect from meat? What is meat to you? And there were so many interesting answers. Like we got answers like, if I am eating a mutton curry, then I should be able to like, you know, eat the bone marrow also. Exactly. So this is the kind of innovation we need in plant-based meat in India. It's not easy, but I see a lot of brands doing that. And that's just really like hats off.
Yeah. And even in your work of like bridging the talent gap, or even having people interested, because the sector is developing as you're developing, there's no per se rule book to it. So how has that experience been when you're, you know, developing the curriculum for universities or speaking to young women and men, getting them interested when there is still ambition, but there's no clear pathway?
It's very difficult for sure. It is a little bit like building the plane as you fly it.
Right.
I personally thrive in such ecosystems. Like, I really love learning on the job and understanding what can be done. And in general, I think we don't give enough credit to the Indian Jugaad mindset. Mm. Like, people are used to doing this. Nobody has told anyone, like, how to get a job in this sector. I have, like, students across India just coming up and saying, hey, I want to start this. How do I do it? We barely do any hand-holding. They want to do it themselves. You just have to make kind of opportunities available for them and mentor them in the way that we can, and then they kind of take it forward. In saying that, now we've done enough like talent mapping studies as well to know how many jobs the sector will create and in exactly what. So it could be engineering, it could be like scientists, it could be branding and design specialists, because we know that that is an issue for the sector as well. So yeah, the opportunities are boundless for sure.
And you've seen a lot of interest as well from the younger...
For sure. I think in general, there is just growing awareness around climate and a lot of climate anxiety that people just want to be a part of the solution in any way that that they can.
Yeah.
And India especially, like, you have so many engineers cropping up each year, myself included. it's a new enough sector that you can create your own job role and pitch yourself, which is really exciting.
Which is so cool. And another thing that I wanted to ask you actually was, already we're still sunrise sector, but where do you think the next wave of innovation in these products would come from? Again, Climate Week, I attended this talk where it wasn't alternate or smart protein, but it was using mycelium to create structures, to create clothes, to create, hoardings and whatnot. It was more architectural. But I also saw mycelium usage for food. So where do you see this innovation happening in the next, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20? Of course, you wouldn't know 15, 20, but what is just your take on that?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with mycelium. Like, I am personally very excited by mycelium because it is just easily scalable, very cost effective. It's also texturally very similar to meat. So you don't have to do a lot of processing for it to start tasting and looking like meat. So even Beyond Meat, which is one of the biggest companies in the space, just launched a mycelium steak, which is their clean label product. Because if you look at the back of package, it'll just say mushrooms, which is great, right, for the consumer as well. So yeah, biomass fermentation and mycelium is definitely something that even investors have been asking us a lot about. Like, what is this tech? How do we get into it? Because like you said, it's not just food, it's also like fashion, and it's in like building everything. Yeah.
So just clarifying, I feel like y'all are talking about mycelium. I've never heard of it. So like maybe if our listeners would want a dumber down version of what mycelium is.
Yeah. It's mushrooms, essentially. Yeah. It's the protein that you derive from mushrooms. So yeah, it's incredibly scalable. And I think in general, like the fact that it can grow on anything.
That's what.
Yeah.
Like, you see mushrooms, like our friend, she's like a farmer. So like every time she sees a mushroom on the road, like it's literally growing on the trees, which is insane. So you can't imagine how that can go forward.
Yeah. I mean, it blew my mind. I was so fascinated by it. I was doing my AI art version of what would it look like if things are made from mycelium. So it really fascinated me.
Yeah.
But I have a controversial question since you mentioned Beyond Meat. With the whole trajectory of impossible foods, right?
Yeah.
When I was reading this book, which is called The Power Law, and it begins from the story of impossible foods and how Vinod Khosla made this bet, and it was prior to the downfall. So it was this hero story, and he identified and it created a category and took the world by a storm. But then we know what happened and it tanked. And again, I don't expect you to have the answer, of course, but what was your take on it when that happened? Like, how did you also feel?
Yeah, no, it was not great for sure from like a global sector perspective. But I think like any other sector, it's going to go through like its tough times for sure, that there is that valley of death that most emerging sectors go through. And it came right after like a unprecedented boom during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Like, people just really did not want to consume meat because it was associated with zoonotic diseases. And they were just looking for something new and exciting. So that boom was kind of not expected.
Yeah.
And then there was like a sudden crash, which I think was good in the longer run because a lot of startups went back to the drawing board, started thinking like, how can we make a better product, a cost-effective product. We can't be using like the most expensive ingredients. We need to in-house a lot of this.
Yeah.
We need to think backwards into the value chain, maybe work with farmer producer organizations. So overall, it's been a step in the right direction. It was also like really bad macroeconomic conditions.
Yeah.
Like in general, the funding space just took a downturn. Which is really sad because I work with startups on the day-to-day.
Yeah.
So when we talk about fundraising, a lot of my job at that point was also helping startups getting acquired, which is never fun to see. But we are now seeing like a little bit of a spike in terms of investor interest as well. And that's come because public financing has opened up. Like the government has started opening up calls, proposals, grant funding in the space. And then investors are like, okay, we need to be looking back into this. But the exciting thing is that they're now looking to fund the technology that goes into the products and not the product in itself, which is a good sign because that means that startups are going to invest more heavily in the R&D and you're going to end up with better products.
Or maybe cheaper product as well. Because
exactly.
I feel like price in general, like my mom's vegetarian and whenever she's like looking for stuff, she'll have meat once in a while. But like she had this one burger long back from Burger King. I think it was called the Impossible Burger or something like that. And her mind was blown. But then when she was seeing the options, like nothing was comparing. So I guess like when you're saying about like putting in more money in the technology itself, then the product will be better and then the end consumer will be happier.
I think circling back to that question of, It makes sense why we feel so strong that it's a strategic advantage for us as a country when we're investing at the primary source rather than
the end source. Because that's, I think, where the muddling happens. Because if you're just trying to get that end source, the process in which that is reached is just not forgotten, but like not paid enough attention to.
I think a lot of startups also just rushed to market because they saw that boom.
Yeah.
They were just like, okay, I need to get on this like alt protein chain and like just start up. And that didn't really work out. So the brands that we're seeing now is like from really seasoned founders from like a tech background, have worked with like the bigger startups globally, coming to India to bring like a localized product. So all of this is like step in the right direction.
But it totally like blows my mind. Like when you're thinking about like, okay, chicken, and then you're thinking about, okay, like someone in a lab somewhere is like has the technology to make something which will taste like chicken. Like, I can't even think of like, okay, yeah, it's biotechnology. But just the comparison like baffles me. And I feel like maybe that is something that baffles a lot of people as well.
It really is. I've been trying to understand more about this space. And again, through Climate Collective, I met this lady who is a chef, has been a chef. I mean, she's very young. She's 24, 25, has been a chef all her life. Somehow got interested in this space, is working with a startup now that does what you said, which is extracting cells from a chicken to create artificial meat.
Cultivated.
I'm fully explaining it wrong, but...
No, you are. You're right.
And she said, we still can't classify it as vegetarian because the cell is still from the chicken. Mm-hmm. But I was so fascinated to know that she started off as a chef, and that's so important because she then understands the taste and she understands texture, and that's specifically why they've gotten her on board and tried to upskill her from a tech point of view. And like you said, then you'd see such interesting convergence of even careers or professions happening.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. Like, actually, I never thought of like a chef's point of view on all this. Have you, in your experience, like, are you like approaching restaurants to maybe use these products, or like, how has that acceptance been? Like, because right now everything you see is farm to table, like, like the ingredients that what you make the thing will make the taste of that product so much better. There's this whole trend of trad wives, who people want to grow their products at home. Like, there's all this so many dynamics at play. But from a chef perspective, I would love to know, like, what do you think?
Yeah,
and what your conversations have been like.
No, this has actually been our focus for this year. So I'm really glad you guys brought it up. So we had a lot of startups tell us that they want to go the food service route and put out products on plates rather than shelves, because that really controls how it's being experienced by a consumer. Like, if I pick it up and cook it the wrong way, that's it. I'm never trying it again, right? Like, if I overcook it or, like, I don't use the right sauces or whatever. So a lot of our work this year has been meeting chefs who have put these products on their menu, understanding why, what would they have liked more, like what formats, what's quicker, what's faster, like what are you looking at? And this is across like fine dining versus QSR versus like your cafes.
Yeah.
And we're putting out a report on it. So like that's essentially what we're doing. And we're doing like a closed door tasting, trying to understand from different perspectives of like celebrity chefs as well, like what is stopping you from putting this on your menu and how can we make better products? Then we take that kind of strategy that we've gotten from them and take it to startups and be like, hey, this is how you need to go back to the drawing board and improve your products. Essentially a gateway for experiencing the product the way the innovator intended it to. And then maybe I would try to make it the same way at home.
Like edamame, you make it at home, but like I tried it first at the restaurant.
And it didn't work out. Yeah. I think maybe more on a personal level with you, what, apart from of course your journey, what inspires and motivates you to continue doing what you're doing?
Yeah. I guess like there's always the personal mandate because I'm vegan and I didn't grow up vegan. So there is that occasional, I miss my mom's chicken biryani, right? And I really want to eat it, but I don't want to be like contributing to that industry. Like after I started reading more about the sector, it stopped being just climate. It also became a lot more about animal welfare because also, as a woman, if you really like think about the dairy industry, which a lot of people dismiss, right? Thinking that that's not cruel, it's not slaughter, but it's equally cruel because there's like artificial insemination, all of that. So from like a vegan perspective, I would really love to see this industry thrive and for people to accept it and just start eating better sourced food. Apart from that, I think the people, like I keep meeting amazing, inspirational people who are all really like clear-eyed optimists in the space. In a world where there's so much climate anxiety, I just meet people trying to do good and trying to do better every day, which keeps me quite motivated. And lastly, I think just from the 3 years I've been in the space, the kind of growth I've seen in the sector, because when I turned vegan, there were like, I think, two products that I could access. And that wasn't even accessible in Cochin where I was living. And now there's 100 brands in the space. And just seeing each of their journeys and how unique they are keeps me motivated.
I know you touched upon climate and alternative protein throughout our conversation today. But if our listener had, you had to leave them with like three provocations, for example, that they should, they could go home and like ruminate on and think about when it comes to like how, like the relationship between the two or why they should choose it. Do you want two or three or how many ever you would want?
No, I would say it's no longer a future problem. Like in the past, when I've tried to explain why I went vegan for the environment, I've always had to say it in terms of like future generations will suffer. No, this is a problem of our lifetime now. We are seeing the implications of climate change. We're seeing extreme weather conditions and there is a lot of suffering. So I would say don't be ignorant. Start reading up about climate, about how you really have a choice with what you put on your plate. And that is something that might feel like a very small individual choice. And it's easy to say that the big corporations need to be doing their bit, and they do. But there's really things that you can do on an individual level that can make a difference. So it's no longer acceptable to say that, okay, oh yeah, I heard something about this activist. You should also know why they're talking about it, is what I would say.
Yeah, no, genuinely, like, I think y'all had met through the same climate collective, right? So Pratap, when we had interviewed him, we asked him for 5 points on like, how can we see a brighter, cleaner, healthier future, like from a climate perspective? And point number three, I think, was like, stop eating meat.
I think that's the easiest kind of individual choice you can make that'll really make a difference. But I am not of the opinion that, like, I can't go around asking people to eat differently if that's not accessible to them. So if you can be part of the solution in some way or the other, if you're looking to make a difference with your career, there are opportunities out there. And regardless of what you're trained in, I'm sure you'll find a space in the climate.
Yeah, like, let's assume someone does want to, they are curious. How would you advise them to just start or take the, it could be, like you said, maybe a brand, it could just be helping out, it could be research, it could be, you know, so how can someone just make a more conscious effort? One of the things that we're also trying to do with the podcast is facilitate these conversations, but how do we then enable some action from it, you know? So how can one just take that thought forward?
Yeah, I mean, information about the space is readily available, especially from GFI's end as well. We try to be neutral bodies in the space, so you can trust the information that's coming out as well. In terms of opportunities, I would say really try to find the white spaces in the sector. So, like I said earlier, don't rush to market with another product, another nugget, another patty. Even funders and the government and investors in general are looking for specific solutions for the Indian context. So if you're looking to create an ingredient, because most of the ingredients right now for all these products are imported, which is really funny because we are the largest producer but also importer of these products. So there's a processing gap that we're not able to fill. So if you're able to tackle that and produce ingredients that has limited batch-to-batch variabilities of high quality, then you're helping bring down the cost of the final product. So really finding that niches, and that's also available. Like, we've done our research, we've put out, like, if you are looking to research in the space, these are the scientific white spaces. If you're looking to start up, these are the industry white spaces. So really do your own research and find out where you want to really align across the value chain. Because it might be easy to just be like, okay, let me just go to market with a product, but you might not be solving for what needs solving.
And also, alternatively, people can reach out to you or can reach out to Goodfood Institute if they are planning on something. And you can help them scale up.
That's why we're here. Yeah.
So we always ask everyone mainly, how are you in work? How are you a work in progress? How is the work you do a work in progress?
Ooh, good question. I think I'm definitely a work in progress. I think what's helped me, especially in this veganism journey, is that I'm not afraid to be proven wrong. In fact, I kind of want to be. Because I realized I was so wrong for the first, whatever, 20-something years of my life with how I was eating food and the misconceptions and what I was telling myself about it. So even at this point, I think when I first turned vegan, a friend of mine was like, okay, great for you, but you're drinking almond milk and almond is like imported. So that's not very sustainable. I was like, oh shit, yeah, that makes sense. So constantly kind of being open to criticism and evolving and making sure that I'm doing the most that I can has helped me be a work in process and be a work in progress and also be constantly evolving. And apart from that, even from like not a career lens or not from a work lens, like I've just tried to pick up things where I'm a complete beginner, because at the end of the day, like, I think that's really what's going to propel your growth, or you're going to be really stagnant.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that is so important. And we will also ask you for some resources. I know, obviously, Good Food Institute, but maybe 4 or 5 things that we can.
And also, like, any of the papers that you were talking about, if we could get those, like, we can blast them out.
Yeah, 100%. Like, anything I've cited, I will. Yeah. You know.
But thank you so much for being a part of this, teaching us, being patient.
No, thank you so much. This was something, like, as a non-vegetarian, I'd really not thought of or considered, like, the larger perspective on this whole industry as a whole. And I've learned so much today. So thank you so much.
I'm so glad.
And we're so happy we had you on our podcast today.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.